Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There are almost no limits to how far a well-educated woman in America can go these days. If she wants to take a date with her, though, she might run into problems. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Women now make up 57% of the roles in U.S. colleges to men's 43%, which means if a single woman wants a male partner who has as much education as she does, the ratios are off by fully a third. And that mismatch between supply and demand among folks looking for love carries over to a greater number of straight single fish in the sea, and means a lot of objectively great catches can get overlooked in the dating market. Journalist John Berger is here to explain. He's a contributor to Fortune magazine and author of the new book Datenomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. John, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks for having me on Think.
You open the book with the story of a female friend who is successful, she's kind, she's attractive, and single at 41. To be clear, that would be fine if that were what she wanted, but this woman would like to be part of a couple and simply can't find the right guy.
Yeah, I just know so many women like her, and this is how I became interested in the topic. My last two employers, Money Magazine and Fortune Magazine, all the guys seemed to be married, yet all the women, and there seemed to be more women than men, at Money and Fortune, the women all seemed to be unhappily single, even though dating-wise they had much more going for them.
You call the problem the man deficit. What is the man deficit?
Going back to the early 80s, more women than men have been graduating from college, and it's been getting progressively worse every year. Last year, there were 4 women who graduated from college for every 3 men. This has spilled over into the post-college dating world. Now, obviously, this wouldn't matter if we were all more open-minded about who we were willing to date and eventually marry, but the social science on this shows that college grads are increasingly likely to only want to marry other college grads. So we've become, at the same time, this gender ratio imbalance has opened up. Both men and women have become less inclined to marry across socioeconomic boundaries.
You interviewed a professional matchmaker. I was interested to learn that they still exist.
There are a lot of them, and yeah. They make good money.
And she says she spends a lot of her workday trying to convince women to lower their standards.
Yeah, I wouldn't use that. I think that's accurate in terms of what she's describing. I don't like that kind of language because it implies that a guy without a college degree is somehow inferior dating-wise to one with a college degree. And, for me, this is a little bit personal because my wife and I have a friend from college. She's an Ivy League educated school teacher. She's married to a working class guy. They've been happily married 20 years. They've raised a great kid together. And this notion that she married down or lowered her standards or settled, I just find it offensive. And I think so if the point is, yes, we have to expand our dating pool, I agree. But some of this language like dating down or compromising or settling, it makes me a little bit uneasy.
It's interesting that that kind of bias doesn't seem to have existed when men outnumbered women on college campuses and among degree holders in this country.
Well, I mean, it certainly exists among men today. The unwillingness to marry across socioeconomic lines, I think, has increased more among men over the past 50 years than it has among women. It just doesn't penalize men in the same way because the supply of college educated women is so vast. So when men are classist in their dating behavior, they don't face the same penalty as the women do because their dating market is better.
John, how does a mismatched female to male ratio in a given population or given dating market tend to affect the way single men and single women relate to potential partners, the way they treat each other when they are interested?
So it's not just, I mean, the obvious answer is statistically it's harder to find a match for a woman because if you have a dating pool with 4 women for every 3 men, there's going to be one of those 4 women is going to be struggling to find someone. But it's not just a numbers problem. There's been a lot of social science done on the behavioral effects of lopsided gender ratios. And the consensus is that when it's the men who are in oversupply, the whole dating culture becomes more monogamous, more romantic, more emphasis on courtship. But when the women are the ones in oversupply, the dating culture is more sexualized. People are less likely to settle down, less likely to marry. Divorce is more common. And men are generally more likely to play the field.
All right, let's jump back here, because if college-educated people are interested in dating other college-educated people, how did we get to a place where the ratios were off so much in America?
Well, this is a long story. So there are two steps to it. One, if we'd had this conversation 50 years ago, as you implied earlier, the numbers would have been reversed. It would have been many more men than women attending college. And I think the way we got to 50-50 is a two-part process. One, the passage of Title IX in 1972, I believe, certainly leveled the playing field. Before Title IX, college admissions officers were discriminating against female high school applicants. There was this idea out there that women only went to college to get their MRS degree, so to speak. And Title IX certainly leveled the playing field. It made it illegal at least for public colleges, and we can talk about the private ones later, but it made it illegal for public colleges to discriminate against women in the admissions process. The only reason I'm reluctant to give all the credit to Title IX is that this shift of this trend of more women attending college didn't just happen in the U.S. It happened all over the Western world, even in countries where the push for equal rights evolved more slowly. So I think there's another factor involved here, and that involves the pill. The biggest driver of gains in female college enrollment is the expectation of workforce participation. So in other words, if women are getting married at 21 or 22 and having children soon thereafter, they're not going to have a long stay in the workforce, so the value of college education goes down. And I think the pill kind of changed the dynamic and made college a better investment.
There's also the reality, some experts have speculated that the rise of ADHD in boys and the difficulties that boys have in like K-12 may be a factor in their decision not to pursue college or to ultimately leave college before obtaining a degree.
Yeah, so this is the other half of the story. Clearly there's been a huge surge in ADHD diagnoses among boys. The question is, I know for some boys this is definitely a real problem. The question, though, is that are these diagnoses being made in part because the boys are less well-behaved than the girls? And if you look at the neuroscience on child development and brain development, most of the research out there indicates that boys' brains lag about a year behind girl brains in terms of maturity. And this affects both intellectual development and social development. So my belief is that boys generally, not universally, but generally would be better off starting first grade at age 7 rather than age 6. And in fact, if you look at Switzerland, which is one of the rare Western countries where this gender gap in college enrollment does not exist, in Switzerland, kids do 2 years of kindergarten, and thus both boys and girls don't start first grade until age 7. And my thinking is that this gives the boys a year to catch up to the girls.
That's fascinating. Are any parents that you know of in this country thinking about like academic or not even academic, but like social redshirting?
I think they should be. I mean, the school districts themselves can't encourage it because it would be a clear violation of Title IX. However, I one of my hopes for the book is that is to spark a conversation on whether parents should be redshirting boys on their own in order to improve their odds of performing well in school and also going to college.
In terms of looking for a lifetime partner, a marriage partner, if that's what people are doing, historically men have been a little bit older than women at the age of marriage or first marriage. How has that affected the ratios in the United States over time?
Well, obviously, it used to be a bigger deal 50 years ago. And in fact, one of my arguments in Datanomics is that the post-World War II, the 1960s sexual revolution was largely, maybe entirely, a byproduct of that age gap at marriage that you referenced. So you think about how few men were born in 1941, 42, 43, 44, before the end of World War II, versus how many women were born after World War II in 46, 47, 48, 49. And then you pair that with the 3 or 4 or 5 year age gap at marriage, you fast forward 20 years and you end up in smack dab in the middle of the 1960s in a dating pool that had maybe 100 or so women, marriage age women, for every 80, 85 or 90 marriage age men. So there's a long history of lopsided gender ratios affecting not only marriage rates, but sexual behavior.
So you get, just like on a college campus, like a little more hooking up, a little less traditional dating, that sort of thing, and then you get the sexual revolution.
Yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of time on college campuses and doing research about college dating for the book. And it's really clear that the schools that have lopsided gender ratios in favor of women, and the average college these days is about 57 or 58% women, which is 4 women for every 3 men. But there are plenty of colleges that are closer to 60-40, which is 3 women for every 2 men. One of them is in your neck of the woods, Baylor. We all think of, Baylor's a Christian college, Methodist, and you would think that the dating behavior there would be more tame than what you'd find at a secular school. But if you go to, in the book, I use niche.com, N-I-C-H-E. It's a college review website written by students who describe what everything from academics to the cafeteria food to what dating is like at these schools. And it's interesting, Baylor, you think it's a Christian school, there wouldn't be much of a hookup culture. But if you don't mind, I'm going to read to you what the students wrote about dating at Baylor. Okay. So this is from niche.com. Okay. There's nothing X-rated, I promise.
Okay.
So, quote, "To a lot of people, Baylor and Waco are a complete anomaly. The same girls that run in the social hookup circles on Friday night are taking you to church with them on Sunday. The guys practice the requisite Christian business principles, but blow through the Baylor babes that are in endless supply," end quote. So even though this is a good Christian campus, it's clear that this lopsided gender ratio is affecting behavior. And then I'll contrast that to Texas A&M, which is 51% male, which makes it an outlier. Again, most schools are 57-58%, or if not more, female. Texas A&M is mostly male. And the niche.com comment on dating life at Texas A&M is this, quote, "More relationships form as students progress through their years at A&M. The older you get, the more couples you'll see walking under the century tree together and getting ready for that next step in life," end quote.
Wow. So it's a very different 4 years than
it's
the
very
Baylor
different
experience.
So the schools that are mostly male have dating cultures that are very female friendly. Like I did a focus group at Caltech out in Pasadena, California. Caltech, I think, is 60 or 65% male. One of the students told me his dorm had a Valentine's Day tradition in which all the boys made handcrafted Valentines for the girls and then woke up early on Valentine's Day morning to cook them pancakes.
Wow. Very nice. This is Caltech?
Caltech. Send your daughters to Caltech.
John Berger is my guest. He's a contributor to Fortune magazine and author of a new book called Datonomics, How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. If you'd like to weigh in or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Fortune magazine contributor John Berger, whose new book is called Datonomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. John, I think it's safe to say that most 18-year-olds headed off to college are not hoping to have rings on their fingers before they graduate. Should prospective students, though, consider gender ratios when choosing a college?
I think they should, but not necessarily for marriage. Certainly there are some young men and women who are looking for a more, say, adventurous social life in college, and some who are looking for more traditional dating in college. And I think students should just know that a school that's 50-50 or 55% male is going, the social life there is going to skew more towards traditional dating, whereas a college like Baylor or like New York University, which is also 60-40 here or in New York, the 60-40 schools that are 60% female are going to have more of a hookup culture. I'm not trying to be the morality police here, but I do think students should know going in that the sex ratio affects behavior. And certainly if you read the college review guides, there are much less important things that kids are paying attention to, like whether the lasagna is any good at the cafeteria or what the football team is like. So I think if they're going to look at things like that, I think it's reasonable to consider the sex ratio.
Another consideration is the field one chooses to work in. Now, you're not suggesting that anybody go into something that doesn't interest them or in which they have no ability, but after college, many young people meet potential partners for dating on the job. And so if they work in a field where men are hard to come by, women are likely to have a hard time finding a partner, and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, so there are certain fields that are obviously disproportionately male. A lot of the computer and technology areas, architecture is another. In the working class world, mechanics, whether it's cars or airlines, those are male-oriented fields. Now, I'm not suggesting that a school teacher who loves her job but is unlucky at love that she should, retrain to become an airline mechanic. But when somebody is young and trying to figure out what kind of a career they want, if they know that dating is not one of their strong suits, maybe this should be on their checklist.
You conclude that holding out for the perfect man may be a risky strategy for college-educated women if they live in a place where college-educated women outnumber college-educated men. I guess if you marry young, the potential pool is larger.
Yeah, it's a little bit like musical chairs, which I'm sure you and all your listeners played at least once as a kid. So in the first round of musical chairs, basically you have to be not paying attention to not get a chair. But by the last round of musical chairs, you have a 50% chance of losing. And that's kind of what happens math-wise in the dating market. So if you start out with an imbalance of too many women, the more women each time one woman and one man is removed from the dating pool, the ratio among the remaining singles becomes more lopsided. So this is why so many of us seem to know women in their mid-30s or even 40 who literally have everything going for them, yet they're having a harder time dating at 40 than some woman with less going for her may have at 25.
You cover this in the book, and you have some fascinating indices as well. It might surprise a lot of people how much this phenomenon varies out in the professional world after college, depending on what city you live in.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, initially, I did, when I began my research, I actually thought it was going to end up with a different conclusion. I thought this was mainly a big city problem. I thought this was a New York story or L.A. or London, Toronto, that there was something about the labor markets in these big cities that was attracting disproportionate numbers of women. But in fact, it's a nationwide issue. The college gender gap in Montana is actually worse than it is in New York City. So I'm going to preface this by saying it's not just a big city issue. However, there are pockets of the country, mostly out west, where the gender ratios are more female friendly. And they tend to be cities that have bigger tech industries. So Dallas, I know, has a decent sized tech industry. And Dallas, among millennials, has about 23% more college grad women than men in their 20s. And that may sound bad, but the national average is actually 33%. So it's actually a bit better in Dallas than average. But clearly, far and away, the best dating market in the country for women is Silicon Valley, San Jose, California, that area. It's really the only place in the country where college grad men outnumber college grad women by significant numbers. Other good cities for women, Denver, Seattle.
And those men, at least in Silicon Valley, tend to also earn pretty good incomes.
Yeah, yeah. No, so yes, they earn decent incomes. They may be a little bit socially awkward because perhaps they went to Caltech and never, didn't have many girlfriends at college. But the marriages out there are actually much more stable than what you find elsewhere in the country. I think the when I looked at the numbers among college grad women in their 30s, about 4% or exactly 4% of those women were divorced in Santa Clara County, which is a good geographic proxy for Silicon Valley. So 4% separated or divorced in Silicon Valley versus 9% nationally. So you can see, and the marriage rates are higher too. It's about 78% of those women are married in Silicon Valley versus 68% or so nationally. So the marriage rates for women are higher and the divorce rates are lower. So the marriages seem to be more stable.
I want to talk to you about something, John, because reading the entire book, it's very clear that you're progressive and open-minded and not in any way sexist. I don't want people to hear the 10,000-foot view of this and assume that this is like the rules or something. But it is, it's one of those things that there are people, their lives are affected by this. And even if it sounds sort of retro to think about, where you might go to find someone that you could marry, it's something that does matter to individuals.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, a 45-year-old woman in Washington, D.C. with a whole life, a whole circle of friends, a career, is not going to pick up stakes and relocate to Seattle just because the gender ratios are more female-friendly there. I understand that completely, and I'm not suggesting that. But I guess my point is more geared towards younger women, somebody who's just graduating from college or just starting out. I'm just saying maybe put these gender ratios on your checklist when you're trying to figure out where to settle down or where to settle.
So sometimes people get a job in a particular metro area and they're deciding, do I live in the city or do I live in the suburbs? It would seem that for a single person, all the action is, close to downtown. It's not necessarily the best place to find a partner.
And this was one of my more surprising findings. In general, I can't vouch for everywhere, but in general, the gender ratios among college grad singles are more woman-friendly in the suburbs than they are in downtown city areas. So in New York, Westchester County, which is a big suburb in New York City or outside of New York City, it's actually a 50-50 gender ratio among young singles, whereas in New York City itself or in Manhattan, it's about 3 women for every 2 men. So you would think all the men in the suburbs would be married, but counterintuitively, it looks like there are a lot more or relatively more single men in suburbia than there are in the city. And as one of the matchmakers I interviewed told me, she had been recommending suburbia not based on the numbers, but just because her feeling was that men who lived in the suburbs were more commitment-minded.
Hmm. Is it safe to say people who are interested in partnering with someone of the same sex don't experience this phenomenon?
Yes. Yeah, so obviously, if somebody, a gay man, does not care how few or how many women there are, the same way a lesbian woman, her dating life is not affected by how many men or how few men there are. So the LGBT dating world is not necessarily or not really affected by gender ratios. But what's interesting is in gay-friendly cities like San Francisco, Miami, Washington, the gay population actually affects the hetero dating pool in ways that you wouldn't expect. What happens is the cities that we think of as being gay-friendly have disproportionate numbers of gay men, but not disproportionate numbers of lesbian women. So as a result, if you're just looking at the census numbers, you have to kind of do an extra layer of research to kind of peel off just to focus on the heterosexual dating pool, because a disproportionate number of the single men in cities like New York and Washington and Miami are gay.
So it's like the Will and Grace phenomenon. You found the perfect single guy. He just doesn't want to date you.
Exactly.
We have an email here from Nancy, who writes to think@kera.org. Please comment on dating and finding a mate in the 60 and up range. Did you consider the upper end of the dating spectrum?
There's not a whole lot of that in the book. I will say that, as I mentioned earlier, the lopsidedness in college graduation began in the early 1980s. So for somebody who's in their 60s now, that person probably graduated from college 1970 or so. At least among similarly educated people, the gender ratio should be more balanced. However, what frequently happens is that the excess supply of women among the younger crowd does seem to incentivize the men to date down age-wise. And actually, if you look at statistics for divorced but not remarried men versus divorced but not remarried women, there are many more of the women.
Do mismatches in sex ratios and competition for mates affect the viability of same-sex friendships? In other words, are like women competing for the same limited pool of male partners less likely to bond with one another?
I'm not sure about bonding. It was clear from my interviews with single people in big cities that the imbalance had kind of raised the level of competition between women. And I had both men and women comment on this. Now, some of the men were kind of taking advantage of this, and the women were bemoaning it. But there did seem to be this phenomenon of women being more competitive with each other, perhaps because they perceived marriageable men to be in shorter supply.
Do you know this? If the ratios are like the perfect 50-50 and somehow you among heterosexuals within a given population, are there differences in the desire of individuals to find long-term mates? Are women more interested in marrying than men, or vice versa?
There was a study done by a professor named Christina Durante, who I believe she actually had been in Texas. I think she's now at Rutgers University. But she did a psychological study in which she interviewed women about their preference versus of having a family and marriage versus career. And she found that when women believed that marriageable men were harder to find, that they were more inclined to emphasize career over family, and vice versa as well. So I do think there's something to that.
It's interesting as well to consider the way this affects how people behave within the dating market. So, are men in Silicon Valley trying to fix themselves up physically in a way that men in other cities are not? Or are women in, a New York City spending more time making themselves attractive to men than they would somewhere else?
Yeah, in the book I interview a matchmaker who's based in New York City, but she spends a lot of time in Seattle because she has you know, part of her business is Greek-American matchmaking, and Seattle has a big Greek population. And she joked to me, or I think actually it was a she was serious, that Seattle has some of the best-looking men in the country, and that's because the dating market is more competitive for men because there are so many men. So she thinks the men in Seattle spend more time at the gym, spend more time dressing right, looking right, whereas in New York, it's the opposite, that women of all ages look fantastic, and she thinks this has nothing to do with genetics. This is about effort, and that the women are putting more effort into looking the part than women in Seattle who don't have to compete as hard for men.
Leading the trend toward lower rates of marriage overall have been working class Americans. We've known for some time that people who have a college degree are more likely to get married and stay married. Is that likely to change now that these sex ratio mismatches are happening and are likely to continue?
Well, I mean, clearly the economy and people's financial situation does impact their willingness to get married. Although I might argue that it shouldn't, because the studies on this topic have indicated that it's actually more expensive to be single than it is to be married. But that said, I think it's clear from other studies that the recession, for example, did have a negative effect on marriage rates. But what's interesting is if you look at working class people, not non-college educated people in their 20s, 30% of the women are married, but only 22% of the men. So to me, this reflects the opposite gender gap in the working class, in which there are more men than women, and the women are in a better position to pick and choose a mate.
We're speaking this hour with journalist John Berger, who's a contributor to Fortune magazine. His new book is called Dateonomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. If you'd like to share a story or ask a question, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is John Berger. He's a contributor to Fortune magazine and author of a new book called Dateonomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 800-933-5372. That's where we find Wesley on the line in Dallas. Hi, Wesley.
Hi, how's it going?
Great thanks. Show. Thanks.
I was going to ask your guest findings on the role of the current climate of feminism in dating for young men. I know myself, sometimes it's a little bit scary out there, especially to go back to college. My last experience at college was maybe when I was 22, 23, I'm 25 now. And I had a girl claim that I was following her around and all this stuff, so I had to go meet with the dean, counselor, and all that. And that basically killed my want to go back to college. And so this whole conversation about dating people who are college graduates versus not is very interesting to me. And I was just wondering what his take or finding is on that, you know, if he finds that other young men are kind of afraid to get out there in the world with, you know, the threat of some extreme views, if that makes sense.
Thanks for a call, Wesley.
Well, Well, I do have a take on this, although it's probably not exactly what you're looking for. So the social science done on gender ratios, believe it or not, it indicates that when women are in oversupply, feminist movements are actually energized by those lopsided gender ratios. There was a book by a Harvard professor, Marcia Guttentag, who she attributed the rise of feminism in the 1960s and 1970s to lopsided gender ratios among baby boomers. And she felt that the feminist movement was a pushback against men exploiting these numbers to their advantage.
That's fascinating. Let's go back to the phones, 1-800-933-5372. This time, Cheryl is on the line in Hickory Creek. Hello, Cheryl.
Hi. Going back to the homosexual issue and the ratio differences in the sexes, I also wondered if you had the big picture data, if you added in all of the men who are imprisoned in this country versus also all the ones who've been killed in the wars. If you go back to the 60s, you're thinking the Vietnam War. So when you lop all those together, do we have a real issue there with the pool shrinking?
Well, clearly these things do matter. In the African American community, where the incarceration rate, you know, is high, too high in my own view, but the incarceration rate in the African American community is much higher, and as a result, you have an imbalance in the dating market, in the marriage market, not just among college grads, but among all African Americans. But what's interesting there is that the African American community is much more open-minded when it comes to dating across socioeconomic lines. And I think it's because, or in part because, when it comes to education, there are about two African American women graduating from college for every one black man. Now, in terms of war, I did look at this in the book, and perhaps the best example is the 1920s. During World War I, you had about 10 million men in Europe and the U.S. die, and about 20 million who were injured, many grievously. So you had a real shortage of men after World War I, and it's clear to me that the whole flapper generation, the sexual revolution that occurred in the 1920s was certainly influenced by a shortage of men.
You say the marriage of the future may be the mixed-collar marriage, professional woman married to a working-class man.
Yeah, I mean, it's, if you have too many men in the working-class dating pool and too many women in the college-educated dating pool, it just seems obvious to me that those two groups will eventually find each other. And as I said, you already see this in the African-American community, where it's much more common, much more accepted. I don't know, Chris, if you've ever seen a Tyler Perry movie, but there's always an educated woman married to a mechanic with a heart of gold or something like that. You know, in a white movie, you know, you would need like a 5-minute on-screen explanation for why Julia Roberts' CEO character was married to a fireman. So I kind of feel like the African-American community is on the cutting edge, and that what is already increasingly commonplace for them will be more accepted for everyone.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Kara is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Kara.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question on whether is this a phenomenon that you're just seeing in the United States, or if there's other countries that are also experiencing this, and if so, what other countries those are?
It's everywhere. It's pretty much every Western country, and even China. And you would think China would be exempt from this because because of their old one-child policy, there are more marriage-age men than women in China. But even in China, there are 10% more women than men in higher education. So this has nothing to do with public policy. This has, in my mind at least, this has to do with developmental issues in which girls in high school, girls in grade school are developmentally a year ahead of boys. And obviously a developmental issue is going to be the same in the United Kingdom as it is in the United States.
It seems like ultimately this could have interesting economic implications for this country, this mismatch between college-educated men and women entering the workforce.
Yeah, I mean, the the underperformance of boys when it comes to education obviously has much, much bigger implications than just dating. So put the dating issue aside. We need to fix the boy problem in schools. We need to get boys attending college at as high a rate as girls do because the economy requires it. We're operating in an increasingly technological advanced economy in which a higher education is increasingly necessary. So put the dating issue aside. We need to get boys back on track.
Is this the sort of thing that is being discussed widely in academic circles these days? You mentioned a few studies. It sounds like maybe there is starting to be consideration of the really wide rippling effects of what you call the boy problem in schools.
Yeah, I mean, there's been perhaps the leading voice on this is Christina Hoff Sommers, who is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and she wrote a book. I believe the title is "The War Against Boys," and you know, in my mind, she diagnoses the problem really well, and she does a good job illuminating all the ways that boys fall short of girls academically. Just as a parent of two teenage boys, I'm a little unsure that an extra 20 minutes of recess or slightly different reading assignments is really going to make a difference. I believe that the long-term solution is essentially redshirting boys.
Is there reason to think that maybe school has changed along with the kids that we're sending to it?
Well, I know that's the argument. The argument is that school curriculums have become overly female friendly. I'm sure on the margins there is some evidence of that we've gone too far in the wrong direction. I have to admit, though, as a parent, I don't see it as a big deal. I mean, again, I know there's a lot written about this and about how school curriculums are favoring girls. I just don't see it with my own kids.
So you're a parent. I assume you are married or were married.
I am married.
Okay. Yes. Did you think about any of this when you were in the market for the person who became your spouse?
Well, I got married young. I got married at 24. So the short answer is no. None of this was on my radar 20 years ago. But, you know, I mean, it is something I think about with my kids in terms of what the world that, you know, I have 15-year-old twins and, you know, within 10 years or maybe longer, maybe shorter, that, you know, they're going to be in the dating world, so to speak. And I do think about it in terms of them, although I will say that all three of my kids are sick and tired of this whole topic. Let's just say it's embarrassing having your dad write a book about dating.
Yeah. Are these problems evident, I mean, in terms of like the dating pools, even in high schools when young women aren't necessarily looking for someone with a degree because they're all just going to high school, but maybe there are the girls more interested in the boys that, you know, are in National Honor Society or whatever?
I don't know about that, but what's fascinating to me, and what was really fascinating when I was doing the research, is that even though there's data and anecdotal evidence out there that college kids are having more sex than ever, or at least a lot more sex these days than they used to, if you look at United States Centers for Disease Control data on teenage sexuality, on kids age 15 to 19 and what percentage of them are sexually active, that sexual activity or sexually active rate has been in sharp decline. So kids these days, and high school kids these days, are having far less sex than their peers did back in the late 1980s at the height of the AIDS crisis. So to me, what this tells me is this is not a function of MTV or music videos or movies or television or all the other kind of pop culture things that people blame for kids being more sexual.
I think parents all over the North Texas area are fist bumping each other right now to hear those statistics. Let's go back to the phones. We have Ermilo on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Ermilo.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just going to mention that all this information is great, but in my house, both my wife and I have attended college, but she's the only one that's received a degree and then moved on after that. But if we didn't have the two incomes, we wouldn't have been able to afford for her to finish a degree and then continue.
Thanks for calling. He points out the fact that, you know, not everyone is a traditional college student these days and, you know, emerges with a degree at 22 or 23.
Yeah. And certainly, I think, you know, pairings like Armilo's are going to become more common. In fact, I got a tweet the other day from a woman who told me she met her husband only after she unchecked the education box on her online dating site.
Let's take one last call. Marlon is on the line in Dallas. Hey, Marlon.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to ask if there was any sort of advice you would have for 30-somethings in a minority group such as myself who are looking for kind of ultra-specific dating categories, things that like women who like gamers or like to play video games or, you know, like to do things that are typical from the norm, not typical from the norm.
Well, this is a little bit outside my area of expertise, but I assume there are gamer meetups in Dallas and all over the country where you can meet other like-minded people. Sound good?
Is that something you've tried, Marlon?
Fine.
All right. Do your single friends now who are looking for love, John, feel better about themselves and about, like, after they understand these numbers? Like, do you have friends saying, oh, thank goodness it's not me?
Yeah, I mean, and that's certainly what I was aiming for. I mean, I think there have been some reactions, people, who, women in particular, who find it a little bit depressing. But I think for older single female friends of mine who've been dating, who've been struggling at dating for, you know, 10, 15 years, I think for them this kind of puts it into some context and makes them realize that it's not that they're going about it all wrong. It's not that they're bad at dating or that they should have followed mom's advice about joining the book club way back when. It's a demographic problem, not a strategic one.
When you look at the pool of your guy friends who are still single and college educated, are they different somehow than your female friends in the same situation?
Well, this is how I became interested in the book. I honestly, other than a couple people who recently got divorced, for a long time I didn't have any single guy friends, yet I had all of these fantastic single female friends. So at least in my world, my circle of friends, I didn't know many single men, or at least I didn't have any close friends who were single. So, but I will say that the ones who have recently gotten divorced, men who are now divorced in their 40s and got married in their 20s, they are kind of amazed at how much better the dating market is for them now than when they were in their mid-20s. And I think they think, well, they're better dressed or they're more accomplished career-wise, or maybe they're spending a couple more hours at the gym every week, and maybe that's why they think it's about them. When I tell them, it's not about them, it's about the numbers.
The new book by journalist John Berger is called Dateonomics: How Dating Became a Lopsided Numbers Game. John, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.